Michelle's going to bring the first one up from Isaiah 11, and then Irene is going to come up and bring the second one from Revelation straight after.
So the reading is from Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 6. And the branch from Jesse. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The spirit of wisdom and understanding. The spirit of counsel and of power. The spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy, with justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and the little child will lead them.
I'm reading from Revelations 5, 1 to 5. Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seal and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept because no man was found who was worthy to open the scroll or to look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of Judah, the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals."
Thank you, Michelle and Irene, for reading that for us. As I said, the good news this morning is that the sermon's, well, shorter than usual, shall we say. The bad news is, I think at least, it's quite a tough one. Now this week, in our final stop on the journey through Advent, looking through the lens of Narnia, we've arrived at the main event, Aslan himself. Now unless you've not been here this month and you've never read either the book or the film, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, you'll know that Aslan is supposed to represent Jesus. It's an interesting choice by C.S. Lewis, the author, to depict Christ as a lion, but it's one which is rooted in biblical imagery. If we go all the way back to the very beginning of the Bible, to the book of Genesis and chapter 49, we see Jacob is blessing his sons. And when he gets to Judah, he calls Judah a lion's cub and says he will rule. This is the line of the family that Jesus descends from. And then if we flip to the very end of the Bible, to the reading that Irene just shared with us in Revelation 5, we read it will be the lion from the tribe of Judah who will triumph in the end. Now these titles are referring to the promised Messiah, to Jesus, the one who's described as worthy in verse 4 of that Revelation reading. The one who is the little child who's referred to in the first reading from Isaiah 11. One capable of leading lions and wolves, leading all of creation. So my question first for you this morning is, what do you think of when you think of a lion? Anyone? Fierce. I had fierce written down. Well done, Pat. Power. I have power written down as well. This is very good. You're well trained. Anyone else?
Majestic.
Very good. I didn't have majestic written down. Well done, Michael. King of the jungle. Yes, the king of the jungle. I put royalty, so yeah, we'll class that as the same thing, Chris. Yeah, good. Anyone else?
A fierce
Well, we've already had fierce. You've got carnivore. Okay, fine. Thanks, Pete. Anyone else?
Leader of the pride.
Yes, a leader. Yeah. Top of the food chain, yeah. Did someone say dangerous? Oh, dangerous, good. Louise, last one.
You seem to do nothing for an awful lot of time until something really important needs to happen and then they happen. Mm.
Either you've been watching a lot of Attenborough or you're trying really hard to get some sort of theological deepness into this question. When we think of Christ as a lion, we see these things that emphasize, if you like, his divinity rather than his humanity. These are things that go beyond Jesus as man. Top of the food chain, king, royalty. The fierceness, the strength, the leader. These are the things that are describing Jesus, the Son of God, not simply Jesus the man. It reminds us of his connection to all of creation, not simply to humanity. And it might be strange, I guess, to think of Jesus as fierce, as powerful, ready to go into battle, if you like, at a time when the main picture that we have of Jesus is of a small baby, weak, defenseless, lying in a manger. But as I've said before, Advent is as much a time of looking forwards towards what Jesus has promised to do as it is of looking back to what he has already done. And in that time to come, when Jesus has promised to return, the baby-faced Jesus will have been replaced with the lion-faced leader and Messiah Jesus. And this is an image which Aslan embodies very well in both the books and the film. When we're introduced to Aslan in the book, he's depicted as the one who will overthrow the established order. He is a hope bringer. One who brings hope for the oppressed. And such is his power, such is his ability to create, generate this hope, that even the mention of his name ignites an emotional response from those who say it and hear it. And it's probably, I looked at the films, tried to find a clip that expresses this, but the films don't express this as well as the book, where the book describes how especially each of the four children responds differently when they first hear the name of Aslan. C.S. Lewis is introducing us to a God who is not tame, who is not the guarantor of the current world order around us. Instead, Aslan has come to deliver Narnia from tyranny, from suffering, from the bullying power of the White Witch. And the same is true of Jesus' mission to the world. He stands up to the Roman Empire, no less. If you read the first couple of chapters of Luke's Gospel, when he talks about the Nativity, the Christmas story, there's an underlying plot development going on here that Luke is doing, which you don't always recognise at first. But he's actually plotting or picturing, setting up Jesus as an opposite to the Emperor Augustus. And I think I've probably preached about it in the past. I've done so much stuff preaching on Luke around Christmas. I deliberately didn't go into it this year. And yet, here I am, 3 days before Christmas, talking about Luke's gospel and Christmas and what he's getting on about. But if you want to know more, talk to me afterwards. But there's a sense that Jesus has come to stand up to the Roman Empire. He stands up to the religious leaders of his day. He comes to show the Jewish people that the religiosity of this order of doing things, this oppressive and life-draining way of Jewish life that the Pharisees and the Sadducees had come to instill, was not what God had intended. It ceased to become life-giving. For 2,000 years, people from across the globe have come to seek and put their trust in this same Jesus. And he has been delivering them from tyranny and suffering, from the bullying power of oppressors and governments, providing hope and joy and peace, even in the darkest places. If you wonder whether that's true, then look around the world at where Christianity thrives. If Christianity was only effective if life was comfortable, then it would thrive in the West. But instead, it's thriving in some of the poorest parts of Africa. It's thriving in places in the Middle East where it's not even legal to be a Christian, where you can't practice your faith openly. It's thriving in places like China, where you can be arrested for trying to preach the gospel. It's even come into places like North Korea. Jesus comes to bring hope in dark places, to speak out against oppression and suffering. And the motivator behind all of this is love. This is a deep love that goes beyond simply feelings. We talk about love, and I think our first thought is that this is a feeling. Love is a feeling that we have towards one another, and it maybe prompts actions and ways that we behave. Jesus' love for us is so deep, it goes beyond simply feelings. It's a love that is unrelenting, a love that's unstoppable in its determination to act and bring about change. But it's also a love that is inescapably bound to truth. Let me ask you another quick question. Is there anything that Jesus can't do? No, says Liliane. Interesting. Well, there are things that Jesus can't do, despite what Sunday school might teach. Jesus cannot make truth untrue. There are other things as well, but this is what I'm focusing on this morning. Jesus cannot make the truth untrue. And we see this in action in the book in Narnia when Aslan is confronted by the witch. And she speaks of the ancient laws concerning those who betray Aslan, and that the laws state that they then belong to her. And Aslan cannot simply undo or ignore these laws for Edmund. And this is what then prompts his sacrifice when he speaks with the witch and he offers himself to her in place of Edmund. There is something that is undeniable about truth once it's learned. You cannot unlearn truth. You cannot undo truth. And yet in our world, just as in Narnia, there seems to have been a kind of layer that's developed between ourselves and reality. Between ourselves and truth. Now in Narnia, that's represented by the snow that never melts under the witch's rule or curse. The truth of who or what Narnia is covered, it's hidden. Like this snow covering the stage. Behind these layers of snow and frost, there is a denial of life and freedom. Creation is stifled. And in our world, the truth of God has become covered by layer upon layer of stuff. Stuff that denies life and freedom. Now I wonder this morning, what distracts you from the truths about God? What hides God's true intention for a fullness of life for you? Now, I think some things are quite obvious. Materialism, greed, selfishness. These things can cover up the reality of what God intends for life from us. But there's other less obvious things that obscure what God has intended life to be. I think the constant promotion of the individual above the collective, to the point where we idolize ourselves. The false idol of finding love at all costs as the only route to happiness. If that was true, then single people could never be happy, and that is not true. The gradual acceptance of the status quo, which diminishes our belief that in the God who can change things. And the consequences of that are that we go down a route that leads us to apathy. We don't really care. Well, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I go through the motions. We are so easily disconnected from the truths of God that we lose the sense of joy and hope that comes from the possibility that He wants to change and remove those layers that exist. That God can and will melt those layers away, just as Aslan melts the layers of snow. The one who liberates us is Jesus Christ. But if we want to be connected, or reconnected, I guess, with the reality of God, it comes with a price. Now, I've mentioned before that in the book and in the films, Aslan is described as not safe, only good. He's not a safe lion, a tame lion, but he is a good lion. And the same is true for Jesus. Once we have encountered Jesus, once we recognize him for who he is and have been filled with his spirit, there is no room for any other reality. The price of knowing Jesus is to also know that there is no other way, that there is no alternative. And that is a huge cost in our modern world. Maybe that cost is higher now than it's ever been in 2,000 years. Because the quality of life that we can enjoy is so high. That ceiling is so high. And we haven't got to turn away from all of that by being a Christian. We're not all called to be hermits in a cave in the middle of the desert. Thank God for that. But it does come with a cost. That's the price of knowing the truth of who Jesus is. And the challenge for those of us, particularly I'm talking to, have been following Jesus for a long time, is to still believe that there is hope for change in spite of what life throws at you. That true joy can still be found in Christ and in Christ alone, even when it seems distant. We're near the end of 2019. We're near the end of this decade. Now, some of you will look back in the past year, the past 10 years, and see lots of positives, lots of things to rejoice in, lots of good things that have happened. Others will look back and think, oh, goodness me, I can't wait till that clock to change over into 2020. Because this has been a terrible year, it's been a terrible decade. And maybe for the majority of us, we're somewhere in between. Might have been a good year, a bad year, but over the course of the last 10, there's been good bits and bad bits and bits in the middle. Can true joy still be found when we're going through those really difficult patches where Christ seems distant and we're caught between those two things of this is my current lived reality, this is what's going on in my life, And yet this is the truth that I know about who Jesus is. And right now there seems to be a really big gap between the two of them. You're experiencing the cost of following Christ, the cost of knowing the truth of who Jesus is. And if we're really honest with ourselves, many of us will know that there are times when our faith and our trust in God is running low. It's like when you drive the car and the fuel light comes on. And depending on how good your car is, can depend how much fuel you know how much fuel is left in the tank. If you've got a bit of an old car, and if you've got one where the warning light is a bit iffy, where it could be 50 miles or it could be 5, and you're running this dicey trip every time you go, oh, well, I'm only going to Tesco, so I reckon I could get there and back and that'll be fine. Can I make it to the Acle Strait on the other side? There are times spiritually where the fuel light is on and we're not really sure how many miles are left in the tank. And in those times, as followers of Christ, we're confronted again with the hard truth that once we've experienced Jesus, there is no other route. There is no other alternative. There is no other petrol station to go to fill up that tank. Only Christ will fill it again for us. We're left with his call to follow, to trust, to even hope. Hope in the God who brings change through Christ. We are left with his promises, and as we've read this morning from Isaiah and from Revelation, promises of what God will do, of the future God has planned for us and all of creation. So this morning I encourage you, if you're feeling like that, if the fuel light's on low, even if you've hit empty and the car's conked out. And that's happened to me before, only once. But Claire was driving, so it was her fault. If you're feeling like that this morning and you're struggling, turn back to the promises of Christ. As you look at Christmas again this year, just a couple of days left and everyone's getting excited and you're worrying about what shopping have I still got to get. Remind yourselves of why Christ came into the world, of the hope that he came to instill, of the joy that can be found because Christ has come to bring truth and revelation, that he's come to bring change, that he's come to melt the layers away that have built up between us and the reality of who God is. Turn back to him. Be angry at him if you want. You can shout at God. He can cope. He's got broad shoulders. You can be upset with God. He doesn't get weird when people cry in front of him. You can be honest with God. But don't run from him. Because you know, particularly if you're already a follower of Jesus, you know you're running nowhere. Turn back to him. Ask him to reignite that hope within you. That is the power of Christmas to do that. The power of Jesus' advent, the power of his promises to return. Let me pray for you.